Welcome to Women in B2B Marketing, a show where CMOs, VPs of marketing, and all strong women leaders in B2B discuss their top tactics, strategies, and tips for building high-performing teams, leveraging trends, and ultimately rocking their marketing careers. Made by and for women, insightful for all. I'm your host and 15-year B2B marketer, Jane Sarah. Let's dive in. Okay, welcome everybody to another episode of Women in B2B Marketing. So excited for our guest today. We have Alice Walker, who is the Senior Product and Partner Marketing Manager at Lean Data. We're going to dive into both product and partner and so much more. And she has over 12 years of experience in B2B marketing. So Alice, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We have so much to talk about. First, what I love to dive into is, how did you get into this lovely world of B2B marketing? How did you find yourself here, your career path?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny story. I found myself here completely by accident. And when I first got started in the working world in sort of corporate America, I began just as an administrative assistant, which is a really great foundation for corporate America. But I found myself, you know, feeling a little stuck, feeling a little stagnant in that role. And so I did what I always do when I have a big challenge, is I took myself to a bookstore and I literally bought a book. I was in my early 20s at the time. And I bought this book called Overnight Career Choice. And I just filled out a bunch of quiz questions. And then at the end of it, it told me I should be a technical writer. Oh. And so I thought, okay, well, if a book tells me that that's what I should do with my life, I guess I'll go do that. And by coincidence, a friend of my sister was in technical marketing. And so I had an informational interview with her, just called her and just kind of wanted to get an idea of what that even meant, to get a sense of what that could possibly mean job-wise. And, you know, wouldn't you know it, her department was hiring for an entry-level technical marketer. Yeah, it was my first kind of introduction into networking. And that sort of got me started. It was for a B2B software company doing technical marketing. And that kind of brought me into this space and got me that first foot in the door. So yeah, I'm very much by accident, all from a quiz out of a book.
I love that. If you recall, you don't have to right now, but if you remember the name of the book, I would love to drop a link to that, because I'm sure so many of us are curious what it would say for us.
I'm pretty sure it was called Overnight Career Choice or Overnight Career Decision. I will look and see if I can find it.
Awesome. If we find it, everyone, I'll drop it in the show notes. That I will definitely be looking that up. Quite literal, like the name of this show, right? Exactly. Yeah. What it is.
Yeah.
I love that. That's amazing. And you've also in your career gone into the healthcare space, which I'm curious about, because every time, you know, whenever you're job hunting and you look through the bajillions of applications out there, everything that's healthcare requires X million years of experience in healthcare. And I'm always curious, you know, the famous chicken egg, like how do you get experience if everyone wants experience? But any idea, if anyone wants to get into the health tech space, what to look for or anything you learned in that space, I'm curious about.
For moving into healthcare, I would say it's like any type of industry that you want to move into. I think you have to be willing to sacrifice something. So if you really want to move into healthcare, which is a really interesting and viable industry and space to be in, there's a lot of innovation happening in the industry. I think you have to be willing to take a step back. You know, to get in the industry, you might need to say, okay, I'll take a role that's a little bit lower. I'll take a salary that's a little bit less. I'll move sideways, laterally down to get in that industry. And I think it would be the same advice for anyone who wants to work, you know, in AI or, you know, higher education, any place where you're not a slam dunk candidate. I think you have to be willing to be flexible and you have to be willing to understand kind of what you're willing to sacrifice to get to that. So making sure you kind of understand what the long-term gains are and if that's something that you're going to be able to, you know, make up that title or that salary or whatever it is that you need to give up to get there.
That's a really good point. And it does apply to any new industry you're trying to break into or even role, right? If you're not in rep ops and you want to switch into that side of things, you typically will need to take a step down or pay cut or both and kind of relearn and learn that new space. So good point. I'm also curious, your current title has product and partner together. How does that work? I've never seen that before, but that, you know, that's just me. So how does it work together? And is there a benefit in having the two in one role?
Yeah, it is a little bit of a unicorn role. I have a background. I've been in marketing, you know, for the last 12 years, wearing a lot of different hats. I worked for consultancy for years, which is a really great way to get a lot of experience doing a lot of different things. And product marketing was a portion of that, and partnerships and partnership development and building out the actual function of partnership as it relates to sales was a, you know, a different hat I wore. So when I saw that this role was available at Lean Data, that was the mix of both. It was what really attracted me to it in the first place, because I did have that experience kind of working in these two areas that honestly don't naturally go together. Usually you have someone who's experienced in partnerships, that someone will likely have a background in sales. That's really common. Occasionally, customer success or customer marketing, but often partners is an extension and just a different channel for sales. And then product marketing, you know, often you'll see people who have, you know, product management experience, product or marketing experience. So ultimately, I do think the two of them work really well together. They do go hand in hand because everything absolutely comes down to product fit, right? You need to understand your product. You need to understand your partner's product, and you need to understand how that fits for the customer. And in both roles, looking at all of them, they're really hyper customer centric, right? So when you're in product marketing and when you're in partnerships, you're always asking yourself the same question, which is, how can I get our clients more? How can I delight our customers? And how can I get new ones, right? So pairing those together, I do think is really natural. You want to make sure that your partners have the ability to market themselves and market their own product along with yours. You also need the ability, I think, to speak a couple of different languages, which just kind of comes part and parcel from having a little bit of experience in sales. And, you know, to anyone listening who's interested in partnership specifically, getting some type of sales experience on your resume, I can't recommend it highly enough. It is so good, not only for your understanding of what it takes to, you know, run a business, but to really understand the product and to understand what people are looking for and what resonates. So a little bit of early unsolicited advice there, but sales and partnerships are all really connected together, and it just comes down to value. And if you could understand value, you know, you can do a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's such good advice. Very much solicited. Tell us everything. I'm just having a flashback to a past position, and I had somebody at a past company, shout out to Jenna Ochoa, who is doing product and partnerships kind of together. Do you ever work with partners to identify product opportunities that would help you better sell or position from a marketing standpoint the product?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a really core part of it. When you think of partnerships, I find the acronym that I find to be the most helpful and the most apt is, it's called ecosystem-led growth, right? Which is sort of the partner flavor of product-led growth or sales-led growth, right? There's a few different versions of it. But within ecosystem-led growth, you're really saying, okay, let me see within the ecosystem that I already exist in, right? Let me look at the people who is in this ecosystem already with me, right? Who am I a trusted advisor to, and who is a trusted advisor to me? And if I can connect those two together, all of a sudden you're maximizing the value to your clients, right? Because you are essentially transitioning over that trusted relationship. And to do that, you know, in some cases, that's absolutely going to be product, right? You're going to say, hey, we have this product and here's this integration, right? That goes together really well. You have companies where that's entirely what it's built off of. In some cases, you might have partnerships where you'd say, hey, here's a service that's going to go well. You love this product. Here's someone who's going to be able to take this product and take it to the next level. And it's really understanding, again, what the value is to your client and to your prospect and what specific problem you're trying to solve. I think, you know, in some cases, partnerships can get a really bad rap because in some cases, when they're not done correctly, when there isn't the level of alignment and executive buy-in and talent involved, you have, all right, I've got a spreadsheet that my salesperson is going to send over to their salesperson, and we're going to compare. Maybe it's going to be modernized and we'll do this on Crossbeam and we'll see where we have overlapping clients. And then we'll start doing sales outreach to those existing clients where there's overlap. And I think, you know, that's where people can get into a lot of trouble because you are looking at what is the value to me, right? As a seller, what is the value to my quota? What is the value to my company of trying to hit this particular number? And you're not thinking of what is this product and service going to do for, you know, the person on the other end? And that's what turns people off to it, right? You know, people never get mad when they're offered something that they really want, right? People always say, nobody ever buys, you know, a drill. They buy the hole that they need in the wall, right? There's some idiom of that. And ultimately, what this partner and what this product fit needs to be is making sure you understand, okay, what's that right hole in the wall? And if you're selling the wrong one to the wrong person, it's not going to go anywhere and you're not going to do anything. And you're going to see a lot of misalignment. And within the last year, a lot of partner budgets have been slashed, right? This economy has not been friendly. Budgets have been frozen. We're seeing buying committees have expanded, right? You're not just selling to one person anymore. You're selling to many different people, in many cases, a CFO, where you have to really make a strong financial case for it. And if you don't have that value there, and if you don't have that alignment, that's not going to go anywhere. And if you don't have a company that says, yes, we believe in this ecosystem and we believe in these connections, you know, of course, those teams are going to be the first ones cut.
So true. I have so many follow-up questions. I'm torn on which avenue to go down first, but let's dig on this. And then I want to get into the economy because that is a doozy of a topic to dive into. But first, you mentioned the ecosystem-led growth. I love this term. This term is pretty new to me. I think only a few months ago I heard of it, and it's beautiful. And I usually hate naming things because there's overabundance.
Totally B2B. You gotta have some acronym in there, right?
Yeah, exactly. But this one makes sense. I like it. You're already kind of selling me on product and marketing. I mean, product kind of is involved. Product marketing is kind of woven through all aspects of marketing, right? And being leveraged alongside partnerships is so interesting to me because when you're talking to partners, you're most likely uncovering what the conversations they're having in the market or new challenges that their clients are facing. And you're broadening, like I leverage partners to broaden our reach from a marketing perspective, but you're able to also broaden your awareness from a product standpoint and pain points that you can solve and opportunity standpoint, right? Like even deeper than the marketing side.
Yeah, I think one of the things, it is a little bit of a perspective. If you can get into the right conversations, right? If you can meet with your partners and you can really understand, you know, what are the pain points that you're solving for? What are the challenges that you're doing? If we do put something together where we say, hey, you know, we want to put together a webinar, right? Like what do people need to learn about now, right? What's going to be helpful for people to understand? I think it's very easy, I think, in any position, right? In partnerships, in sales, in marketing, when you are at one organization, so much of being good at your job means you need to really specialize in your role and in your audience and what's being said. And I think the antidote to that, right? And the antidote of only seeing this one particular thing and thinking about one thing one particular way is to just be a really good listener. And to listen, you know, this is a big part of product marketing, right? Is you need to be listening to what your customers are saying. You need to be listening to what your prospects are saying. And in order to be a good, I think, partner to sales generally, you need to understand what sales is hearing and what's going on in the front lines and listening to those sales conversations. I think that's one of the most underused technologies is those sales call recording tools, right? Marketers, for the most part, you can go listen to that and you can hear what people are telling, you know, your BDRs, your SDRs, your account executives. And that is gold. And that is so hard to mine out of, you know, notes or outputs or win-loss analysis. And the partnership aspect of it, I see that as an amplification of it. It's sort of a layer even larger. It takes you outside of what, you know, your sales team or your customers are saying, or the customers that maybe, you know, your close lost deals, right? The people that, the ones that got away. You can start hearing what people are saying in other partnerships, in other organizations. Maybe you're targeting the same demographic, right? Maybe it's looking at the same people who are having similar conversations. I certainly think in B2B tech, you know, you'll say like, what's the biggest challenge plaguing, you know, the head of RevOps, right? Okay, maybe that is going to look really similar from Lean Data over to Sixth Sense, right? But not necessarily. And those asking the right questions and really looking to kind of uncover the real pain points that's there, I see that as the other side of the coin, right? Which is the value that you bring within the partnership. So it's like you have to understand what's the pain that people are having, what's the problem that they're solving. And then you need to understand like, okay, what are we bringing to the party and why is it stronger with this other organization?
Yes. Like why does the, what is that expression? It's used in many ways, but 1+1=3, right? We bring on a partner, not just for reach, but for what you can accomplish together. Integration or not, sometimes just the power of two platforms in one can amplify the results and the ROI. So that's huge.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of that. And, you know, you see a lot of it, I think for a long time, we were seeing 1+1=3 in acquisitions. Right? Saying, oh, 1+1=3. Great. We'll get this company. We'll merge it with this company. We'll get this company. We'll merge it with this company. Okay. And I think the last couple of years has proven that not to be entirely successful in many ways. Right. And we've found that's been to the detriment, I think, of a lot of companies and a lot of organizations. And so now we're saying, okay, well, can we get to 1+1=3 just through partnership? Right. And I think it really, it goes back to that high-level executive alignment of does this truly make sense and ultimately fiscal sense for both companies? And if you have that high-level executive alignment and then you can get to, you know, what does this do for our clients? That starts solving a lot of those problems without having to say like, you know, okay, we need to acquire this company or we need to build out this entire new other new feature within our product, which is going to take a year and cost X amount of money. When instead we could just partner to solve it. And if you find the right partner, that does get you farther faster if you do that the right way.
That's so true. So you, in working with the partner and product teams, two things. One, I want to ask how closely, I imagine very closely, you work with sales on both sides, with your partners and internally. And second, I wonder if also by speaking more with your partners and identifying the issues and challenges, you probably also get a lot of competitive intel, right? Like, oh, we're not able to accomplish XYZ on clients with using this platform, but with Lean Data, we're able to accomplish this together. Like, you must also be able to get that kind of insight too.
Yeah. Let me take the first one and then we'll dig into the second one. Both great questions and kind of have a little bit of nuanced answers. Ultimately, I really believe that every component of an organization ideally should work in service of sales. And that's not always an extremely popular sentiment, right? But if you don't have sales, people don't have jobs, right? If you don't have sales, if you don't have numbers, you could have the best customer research in the world. You could have the best win-loss analysis. You could have the most beautiful personas. And none of that matters, right? This is why I think having some degree of background in sales is so important. Having the opportunity to kind of co-sell alongside of account executives was really, really formative for me career-wise because it really made me understand both what it takes to close a deal, which is, you know, Herculean in some cases, and also all of the different pieces that need to work together. I think sometimes if you don't have that good marketing and sales alignment or customer success and sales alignment or anything in sales alignment, right, you get to that, things can get a little bit more fractured within the company because it all isn't in service of, you know, how can we make sure we're making the company as successful as possible, which again, I think is just a fancier way of saying sales. So that's a long way of saying, I think you have to work closely with sales because you have to understand what they need. And they'll tell you, right? Like they want that enablement. They want that help. They, you know, they know the areas where they're struggling or where they're losing deals, and they are incredibly motivated for that not to be the case. So I think the more that you can really have that true partnership, the more successful you're going to be. And I would say that would be my same answer, regardless of what department you work in at an organization. I mean, maybe it's less relevant if you're in, you know, human resources or accounting or something. But the more connected you can be in to revenue, the stronger it is and the better perspective you're going to have. I think that's huge for partnership, certainly. I think it's humongous for product marketing, understanding the market fit, understanding who we're marketing to, understanding the pain points that we're solving for. And then to your second question, in some cases you do. I mean, I think there is a lot that happens in those conversations off the record, right? In some cases, you're getting really, really helpful, you know, inferences about what's going on and where deals are winning and losing. I also think it depends on kind of the scope of conversations, right? A lot of times when you're selling, you're focused on your sales cycle and what's happening and how you can get it to close. And so broadening that out and bringing in those insights to your partners, that's harder to get to. But again, that's where that value of that ecosystem is. And that's where you have to look at partners, not just in the sense of like, we signed a DocuSign and we're connected on Crossbeam, but my success is your success, right? My quota is your quota, right? How many partnerships think in that terms? I think maybe not as many as there should. But I think when you get to that point, that's when you can start really extracting some of those competitive insights in ways that it's just harder to when you're just looking at, you know, okay, who do we have in our TAM that matches up? Okay, great. Like, let's go get them. Send it over to our BDRs.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the default step one now for partners, right? Partnerships is Crossbeam and mapping the accounts. I want to take it back to earlier when I had just a million questions and paths to go down. The down economy you brought up, right? I think I've said on past podcasts, the first thing that I've seen cut, especially in the past couple of years during these layoffs, has been partner marketing teams. And it just always blows my mind because it is the biggest growth opportunity, in my opinion. Like, partner marketing has always been a number one driver for me at all companies I've worked at. It's just been huge. So to cut that just is crazy when you're trying to do more with less. Partnerships is what, like you've said earlier, allows you to amplify everything, right? Your reach, your insight, product info, sales enablement, everything. So how have you just grown these partner efforts in the down economy? And what's your take on them being the first to be cut, seemingly, from my LinkedIn feed, very subjective?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen that as well. I think it goes back to executive alignment, as so many things do, right? I think you'll see it as well with, you know, in organizations that don't have a high level of trust and investment in marketing, you're going to lose marketing. When executives are making those high level decisions, it's the area of the business that has the least amount of either faith or data, or in some cases, both, right? So the organizations, I think, where you see the partner with the marketing, the partner team getting cut are going to be organizations where the executives don't see the value. And the executives might not see the value for a lot of different reasons, right? Maybe they think it's just a glorified version of sales and they feel like they've got their sales reps that are already doing it. And that's that. They don't need to worry about it, right? Maybe you have trouble with your metrics. That's a big part of it. You know, so much of sales is so concrete, right? You have your opportunity life cycle. It follows all the different stages. You have your entry and exit criteria. And it's a numbers game, right? You know if you're doing well with sales and you know if you're not doing well with sales. There's really very little subjective about it. I think that's where partnerships needs to move to have a similar level of just scoreboard aspect to it, right? How can we track it? What are the numbers? What are the metrics? And whatever those numbers and metrics are that it's measured against, there needs to be executive alignment that this is the correct way to track and measure it. You know, if you have a partner team that says, hey, I'm measuring everything this way, then we're doing great and our numbers are off the chart, and you have executives that say that data is not real, we don't trust it, That's not a partner team. That's going to be there long term. And also that shows the fundamental misalignment between the executives and the partner team. So ultimately, I think we're going to see ecosystem-led growth flourish at organizations where you already have that executive buy-in, that yes, this is valuable. Yes, this is something that's going to make us money. And that's going to be run by executives who, frankly, have already made a ton of money off of ecosystem-led growth and are wanting to duplicate that effort in a more streamlined manner.
And speaking of alignment and streamlining, again, two questions. You're making the brain work today, Alice. So one, I'm curious if you have any specifics on how you achieve that exec alignment with your team or on your end, just how you align on what metrics you're looking at. If you have any kind of tips or stories on that specific point. And then second, I also am curious, I think I saw something on your LinkedIn about this and just knowing that you're juggling so many things, right, with product and partner marketing is how you stay aligned yourself and organized, like what processes you use that are kind of something you bring to different companies that are tried and true for you.
Yeah. Oh, man, such good questions on both cases. Look, this might sound rough, but in my opinion, if you are having to convince, you know, a CEO of the value of partnerships or the value of marketing, you should be looking for another gig in another org. Ultimately, yeah. I think if you are in the position of having to pitch it and to market it and to prove it, it's an uphill battle because you are going to need to carve out budget. You're going to need to carve out process. You're going to need to carve out headcount. You're going to need to carve out a lot of things. And if you have someone that fundamentally doesn't think that that's worthwhile, it's going to be a really uphill battle. That's not to say it's impossible. That's not to say that people can't ever do it. But man, is that going to be a challenge? I think better to, as you're looking at organizations, right, as you're interviewing, as you're informally networking, which I think everyone should be doing very casually at all times, you know, just getting a sense of their partner team, you know, or their marketing team or whatever it is, that particular flavor that you're looking for, and get a sense for how invested they are in it. Get a sense for what they've seen success in. Get a sense for what their strategic initiatives are for the year and how those different verticals fit in. I think when you have that alignment between the teams and between the executives, it's a lot easier to build your case. It's a lot easier to build your, you know, business level goals and to meet them because there's already that buy-in. But you're going to be fighting a war on two fronts if you're needing to kind of fight for the existence of it. I think another portion of it is just really understanding how they see those particular verticals fitting into their strategy and then making sure that you are really working to drive the success of whatever that particular goal is, right? So maybe you could do a lot more than that particular executive wants, but getting to really understand what's the metric that they're going for, what's the number, what do they want it to look like, and then really just putting your all behind, making sure that you hit and exceed that. That gives you the ability, you know, the next year to say, okay, great, this is what we set out to do. We did it. We more than did it. Let's talk about what this could look like at a larger level. And in some ways, that's where you can have that credentialing of yourself. Not the credentialing of, is this worthwhile in the first place? But the credentialing of, you've seen that I can get results. You've seen that I can execute to a plan. You know, you've seen that we can hit these numbers. Let's look at this at a bigger level. And, you know, another truism, I think that's really relevant here is that, you know, revenue solves all problems. You know, when it a department or a division or a program that is a revenue driver, there's leeway.
There's that trust.
And there's trust that comes. And if you're not, you know, I think that's an area where you need to be rethinking, you know, what it is that you're doing and why isn't it connected to revenue and what can you do immediately to try and kind of quickly change course?
Yeah, speak their language for instant alignment and everyone's language at the end of the day comes back to revenue.
It all comes back to revenue, always. always, it's a business. We're here to support the goals of the organization and the goals of the organization, unless you're working in a different, you know, government or nonprofit sector, which is utterly not my world and I would not even want to begin to speak to. But, you know, B2B space that we're working in, like, it's revenue. And that's why that relationship to sales is so important. And that's why understanding, you know, that executive alignment is so crucial. If you don't have those two pieces, you're vulnerable. You know, you're going to be vulnerable anyway. That's just life in the layoff economy. But
yes,
I think it's a stronger position to be in.
Yes. So in the partner specific space, it's not reporting on, I have 5 partner webinars planned for the next quarter. It's from the partner webinars we hosted last quarter, these are the opportunities that came about, and this is the closed one revenue that came in, and tying it back to that. So everyone's on the same page that we can amplify this with XYZ more resources.
Yeah. Having your metrics set up, right? Of saying, you know, here's how we're tracking influence. Here's how we're tracking referrals. Here's how we're tracking this information. Again, making sure that that's not just you kind of in a void saying, here's my data, and people looking at it and not trusting it. Data is only as good as the trust that people have in it. But it's then saying, okay, based on all of this data, here's how this is performing. Right. And if you don't have data for something, but if you have a really strong gut feeling about it, making sure that you have as many data points as possible, that things are as well tested as possible, and that you are continuing to sort of connect all of these different things into what this looks like for sales and what that looks like on the other end.
Yep. So true. And keeping yourself organized, do you have any processes, even if it's tools, or I think I saw that something with Scrum is on your LinkedIn profile. So I'm curious if that's a methodology you swear by, or what is that? V2 Mom, Salesforce? There's so many different methods out there.
There's a lot of them. I've used a lot of them. I'm a former Scrum master. So I'm certified in Agile for Marketing.
There we go.
And all of those. I spent time as a project manager. So I think it's less about the specific system that's used and more just that you have a system. I think
the
best system is the one that gets used, right? So in some cases, I think Agile works really, really well. In some cases, I think Agile is incredibly difficult. You know, I used to really, really love and believe in having a project management system like Asana or Monday. And then I ended up at an organization that didn't have one. And I had to do the whole thing in a Google Sheet. And I found, hey, I can build my own project plan in a Google Sheet.
Yeah,
sure. I lose some of the nice tab functionalities in there, but fundamentally, like, I can still project manage just fine out of this on my own. I think having the level of touch base that you need for organization, I think depends on the team and depends on the goals that you have and what the connectivity requires for that. So if you have a team that is more junior, you know, that needs a lot more sort of guidance and collaboration to achieve the goals that you need, then I think having something like Agile where you're having daily scrums, we are having a retrospective at the end, you have that really, you know, consistent touch base, I think is really important. If you have a more senior team that's filled with more individual contributors who are doing their work and doing it well, you don't want to get them in daily standups. They're going to feel smothered, right? You want to make sure they have what they need to understand what the objective is, to go get it. And that you as a manager have the touch points to see, like, are things going well? Are we on track? How are we doing it? I'm a big fan of the stoplight approach, having a meeting with your leads, your managers, or your teams, and just going by milestone, right? Making sure that you're not just getting into everybody's nitty gritty task list and just saying, okay, hey, for milestone A, you know, red, yellow, or green. Right. And if it's red, we stop everything and we problem solve it together. If it's yellow, okay, we're keeping an eye on it. Maybe we're spinning up a separate. And if it's green, great, we're moving on to the next topic. We're not going to linger about, you know, every stop along the way. I think things like that, where you can have just quick hits, quick touch bases, you know, you have the temperature of the team and the initiative without making people feel like they're wasting their time is really, really key.
I love that. And you've given me a couple bumper sticker ideas in this call already. Is the best system is the one that gets used, and revenue solves all problems. 2 mantras for the year.
Telling you.
So true. And Alice, I want to get into a little bit of personal stuff because we were chatting before we turned on the mics. You are a mom of two. I've said before on the show, I have the most respect for parents of one, but more than one blows my mind because I don't know how you do it. So I'm curious. I don't think I've ever talked about this on the show. So I'd be curious to ask even more people about this, especially women. But how do you think becoming a mom has impacted your career?
Yeah, it's a big question. It's a good question.
It's a show in and of itself, right?
Yeah. We need a whole other hour just to unpack that. You know, in a lot of ways, being a mom has really, really positively impacted my career. And I think that's a message that I want to get out there to as many women as possible, where we so often hear the opposite.
So true.
I mean, first of all, it makes your career a lot more intentional, right? Because there are some cases where, like, hey, I could save a hell of a lot of money if I stopped working and didn't have to pay for two kids in daycare. You know, I live in California and it is expensive as all get out. And so you have to really say, no, I value my career. I value where I'm at. If that's a choice that makes sense for you, of course. You know, I'm staying in the workforce. I'm going to invest in daycare because I'm investing in my career, and that time off is not what I want to take off for any of the many reasons why you might want to do that. So I think even just there's an intentionality that I feel I have with my career that says, you know, I'm here for a reason. I'm doing this for a reason. I think there are some of the things that are maybe a little bit more trite, but I think they're very true. It makes you become extremely good at time management. You know, yes. I could be working on a giant project and before I had kids, I might, you know, tinker with it and do a little here and a little there. And I'm working on it till 6:30 at night, but now daycare ends at 5 o'clock. I got to be at the door. I got to figure out a way to make sure that my time is managed well to that. I think there's an aspect of it that has, you have to compartmentalize. I think when you're a working mom, I had a challenge with one of my kids at school and I was dealing with it and it was emotionally charged and it was challenging. And then 10 minutes later, I had to get on an interview, right? To interview someone on my team. And you know what? It's not that person on the other end of the interview. It's like, they're waiting on me. They need me to show up and they need me to give them my all. And they need me to not be thinking about any of the stuff that came before. And that's not to say that moms or dads or parents or anyone can't bring their whole selves and have parenting come into work. I think in a lot of ways, that's become a lot more normalized now.
Yes, thankfully.
But in some cases, like, the work just needs to get done. And I could have had a heck of a morning getting my kids off to school and it could have felt not great. But at the end of the day, I need to go into work mode and I need to get that done. And I do think there is amount of, I would say, healthy compartmentalization, you know, that comes from just having so many things going on at once. You kind of need to.
Yes, that's a really good point.
The last sort of piece of this, like, there's a lot here, but the other piece that I think is probably more important than any of the stuff I've just talked about, but I think there is such a huge identity piece that comes from it, right? And I think before kids, so much of what was happening at work was such a huge part of my identity. And it still is, right? It's definitely what I do professionally has a huge bearing on kind of how I see myself. But it's not all of it, right? In the same way that the kids, you know, having kids has a huge bearing on who I am. But that's also not all of it. It really brings the awareness that kind of no matter what's going on at work, like, that isn't everything. Right. And that's not your entire identity, in the same way that, you know, being a mom isn't my entire identity. But having both, I find they kind of balance each other out and really put everything sort of in perspective, for better or worse.
Yes. Perspective is a big one. I wholeheartedly agree. I know we hear the term mom brain a lot as parents and as moms, and it's interesting because I know I use the term myself, and especially in the early years, like, I felt, and there's moments where I'm like, I just don't remember something, mom brain, right? But I also feel like mom brain, we should reclaim that term and make it so positive, because like you said, since becoming a mom, I've become so much better at time management and prioritization, and you're able to get so much more done more efficiently. And it's just like, there's so many positives to it that are interesting and never covered. You always just see the negative stuff in your social feeds, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really hesitant. Like,
I never want to speak ill of something that someone else gets something positive from, right? So if somebody, you know, uses the term mom brain and loves it and feels like that kind of helps them make sense of their life and the challenge that is being a working mom, like, I think that's great. And everyone should use whatever language they don't. I don't care for anything that's unnecessarily gendered. So I find terms like mom brain or, you know, boy mom or things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah. Just boss. I'm with you.
I just don't care for it. I think it brings this level of gender to it. And that by bringing a level of gender to it, it brings a level of dismissiveness to it that you would never have. You know, nobody says dad brain, right? Nobody says boss. I do hear the expression girl dad all the time, which is, you know, fine. And like, again, I'm not here to tell anyone what words to say or not say.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the phrasing does have some unintentional sexism to it, right?
Yes.
And I think words matter and how we talk about ourselves
matter.
And I think, you know, when you have to go back to work after having a baby 3 months ago and they're not sleeping through the night and you're not eating well and you're not sleeping well, like, of course your brain is going to be foggy, right? Of course you're going to be not thinking as well as you could. The fact that you can even perform, I think, is a huge testament. But I think generally writing off, I think coining a phrase around inarticulation to something that is both gendered and gendered for working moms, I do think it doesn't progress the cause, I guess I'll say.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm going to be way more aware of the terms I'm using if I'm unnecessarily gendering something. That's so interesting. For mom brain, because maybe hashtag primary caregiver brain just doesn't.
Right?
It doesn't scroll as well.
Tired.
You know, tired. Exactly.
Hashtag had of it all.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Having a day, right? Just something like that. I'm going to pay more attention to that. That's a really good call out. Thank you. And I know we're running out of time, so I really want to try to fit one thing if you can stay with me a little bit longer.
Time, please.
You were talking about your biggest career hurdle and challenge, right? And the importance of networking. So if you can talk us through this, I would love for you to share your insight there.
Yes, thank you. This is a big one. This is the big imaginary soapbox I'm on pretty much all the time these days. So actually, almost exactly a year ago, we're right at my 1 year anniversary of getting laid off, which, I mean, at this point, who hasn't been laid off in the last year, right?
Seriously.
I feel very happy that the stigma I feel that used to be kind of around getting laid off and what that meant, you know, for who you were as a worker has really sort of dissipated sadly as a casualty of the crazy amounts of layoffs that we had. It was a really interesting experience because prior to that experience, I had always heard the advice from many people, you know, men and women alike, you know, the importance of networking, right? And fostering your network and building your network and having a network. And, you know, I heard all of that ad nauseum. And I really heard it and it just never sat well with me. There was something that always felt like a little gross about it. You know, I was like, I want to go to this like marketing network event and like make small talk with a bunch of strangers who I'm probably never going to speak to again.
Like pitching yourself almost, it feels like.
And just the whole thing felt... You know, I got it intellectually why it made sense, but it wasn't anything I ever really felt like compelled to action on because it always just felt a little kind of weird. And I was like, I'm just going to be me and a good person and a good worker and everything is going to kind of take care of itself, right? If you follow the right steps and nothing bad will ever happen to you, which is completely untrue in every way possible.
If only life worked that way.
that's unfortunately not how anything goes. Yeah, when I was laid off, I found not only was I laid off, but I laid off at a time when the economy was really impacted and everybody, I felt like, was looking for work all at once. And there was a huge lack of marketing jobs and a huge increase in marketers all looking for work at once. And, you know, I was seeing things like, you know, do you want to apply for this job? 700 other people have applied for it, right? And I found that in this particular job market, really the only way you could get a foot in the door anywhere is by having a personal connection, right? And by having someone refer you, by knowing someone at the company, by already having a foot in at the door. So after I was laid off, I really went through my network and I like
was driven like you wouldn't believe. I was driven like someone who was still paying for full-time daycare for two kids, you know, to start, you know, reaching out and people who I hadn't spoken to in years in some cases, and, you know, sharing a little bit about what had happened and basically asking for help. So a lot of my networking was really born out of kind of, you know, desperation and looking for assistance, right? I had to reach out to my network and to my community, and I had to ask a lot of people for help. And it was a really positive experience in so many ways. I'm so grateful to it because the vast majority of people in my network and in my community were just overwhelmingly lovely. You know, they were so supportive, so responsive. Of course, you occasionally get that one message that nobody replies to for whatever reason, and that's totally fine. I'm not subtweeting anyone who might be listening to this, right? But for the most part, you know, people would respond right away, and I got on calls with people, and I talked to people who I hadn't talked to in months or in years, and
it's so great.
They referred me to jobs, and they connected with me with people, and I had informational interviews, and ultimately, I ended up where I am. You know, I had personal connections that kind of started the interview process, and it really made me understand that it's less about networking and it's more about fostering your community and being present in your community and being a voice in your community. And I really wanted to make sure that the next time I was talking to all of these people, I wasn't asking for a favor, right? If anything, I wanted to be able to be giving favors and to paying it forward and paying it back in many ways. And now when I think about networking, I don't think about, you know, going to a weird mixer and wearing a name tag and being awkward. I think about, hey, I need to reach out to that person I worked with 5 years ago who I haven't spoken to, but I loved, you know, I loved working with them, and I just need to say hi and I need to see what they're up to.
Yes.
You know, and I need to just stay in touch and ask them how I can help them, right? What do they need? What's going on in their life or their world that I can support with? The more that I do that, right, should I ever be in a position where I am, you know, looking for work again, which we all likely will be.
Yeah.
That'll be an easier conversation because it's not just, hi, you only hear from me when I need something.
Yes, that's so true. You're making me realize, too, it's a lot like marketing in a way where quality matters so much more than quantity in most cases, right? Like what you're bringing in and who you're talking to, building those quality relationships, be it five people that you keep in touch with or more of this one-to-one reach, right? And building this relationship with them is better than going to an open networking event and, I mean, just having random conversations that you never really remember the people. So those quality conversations and building those relationships are what matter.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to yes and you a little bit there.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we as women can often put a lot of pressure on ourselves to really do things the most. And if we're going to do something, do it the best and make it good and make sure that we have time and effort and do we have bandwidth, you know, do we have all of this, all of this stuff for it? And I think there is something to be said for a simple, hey, I was just thinking about you. How have you been? A text or a LinkedIn message.
I think
if we set things up where we feel like we need to foster these really quality conversations. I mean, not everyone that I've, you know, reached out to would I call in the middle of the night if I'm having a personal emergency, right? Like that, people is still a very select few. But I think there is a lot more, passive networking is not quite the right word, but there is a lower maintenance version of it that I think I would hazard to guess that might be more common that men do than women, that takes a little bit less effort and energy, but that still kind of fosters that connection. And I think that's what I'm interested in doing, right? Not how can I generate 5 or 10 or 20 more really, really close relationships, because that feels overwhelming to me. I've got plenty.
True.
But more, you know, hey, how can I loosely stay in touch with people? How can I stay top of mind? How can people know that if they need something, I am a friendly that they can reach out to? Right.
And yeah.
I think those are the
really good distinction. It goes back. I think you used the words forget networking. It's about building a community. So not necessarily
the relationship side, I was saying, and or deep friendships, yeah. but it's quality connections and quality community that you
build. Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
100%. And I guess plug Women in Revenue, which is a great community that Jane and I are both a part of, that has that and has easy touch points and is free and I think is doing a ton for women in the workplace. So
agreed. Everyone there, check it out. For sure. Well, Alice, thank you so much for joining us today. I apologize we've been a little over. I hope that's okay. But thank you so much.
Such a lovely conversation. I'm so happy that we were able to connect. Thank you.
Same. Likewise. And everybody, if you're listening to the show, if you like the show, rate, review, share with a friend. It helps us get in front of more folks. So thank you, everyone. And thank you again, Alice. And where can everyone get in touch with you and build that community?
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn, Alice A. Walker.
Perfect.
We'll link it on the show notes.
We will for sure. Down below. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jane.